of minutes, because one of my favorite things to do is get to see everybody's faces. And here's the thing that I want to let you know is, as you look at each other, just take each other's faces in as a way of saying hello, as a way of creating our sangha again. And the thing is that nobody knows who's looking at whom when. So it doesn't matter. You don't need to be shy. Just let yourself be seen. Let us see you. This is how we become us for today, for this next hour and a half, that we could even think of it as our hour and a half retreat. Because the reality is not everybody can leave home and attend a multi-day retreat or even a day-long retreat. But when we come here together intentionally for practice, it is a form of retreat, and it's beautiful to take refuge in each other, to take refuge in our practice and in the Dharma. Thank you so much. Look at everybody turning their videos on. This is so sweet. I love this. Thank you for everybody who can do it, and I totally understand why there are reasons why it doesn't work. Okay, so I am joining you from Boulder, Colorado, where it is extremely cold out today. And this is the ancestral land of the Cheyenne and the Arapaho, and probably many other indigenous people as well. And it is a particular honor and privilege to get to be here with you today. So thank you, George. Thank you, Sangha Live. Thank you, Sangha, for being here. So we'll start with about a 20-minute meditation, and then I want to offer a talk, some Dharma thoughts. We'll do a shorter meditation on the other side of the talk and have plenty of time to talk with each other. And I have asked George to turn off the chat during the talk, which I think also helps hold us in a retreat-like setting, that we can just be here and let the words flow through you and around you and take whatever resonates, leave the rest behind. So we'll really try to create this quiet container for all of us today. So as we sit in and enter our meditation, I invite you to find a posture that works well in your body. You might be sitting, you might be standing, or reclining, eyes open or closed, whichever you prefer. And if your eyes are open, have a gentle, soft gaze downward. Because even with open eyes, there can be the turning inward of the awareness. And settling into the body, sensing into the places where the body is touching anything, perhaps the sit bones or the backs of the thighs, the feet, the hands, maybe even noticing how the insides of the upper arms gently touch the sides of the torso. How the tongue rests in the mouth, the lips might be touching. Maybe even noticing the touch of your clothing on your body. A way of becoming grounded in this body. Maybe even saying to yourself, may I be grounded in the body. And then coming up into an awareness of your heart space. Simply noticing, how's the heart today? Whatever is here, letting it be here. Maybe breathing in and out of the heart space for a few breath cycles. Imagine nourishing energy on the in-breath coming into the heart. On the out-breath, letting go of anything at all, a release. May my heart become open, soft, and stable. You can say that to yourself if you like. May my heart become open, soft, and stable. And now sensing into the space of the mind. Just noticing, what is the mind like today? Chattery, restless, maybe quiet, a little still. Whatever it is, it is. May my mind become clear and balanced. Offering yourself that intention if you like. May my mind become clear and balanced. And then noticing the breath. The inhale and the exhale. The spaces in between. Just breathing and knowing you're breathing. If there's any tension in the body, with your next exhale, see if you can soften any amount, maybe loosening the jaw, letting the shoulders melt a little bit, the muscles of the chest and the belly soften. In this moment, may I breathe with ease. Offering yourself that intention. In this moment, may I breathe with ease. May I be grounded in the body. May my heart be open, soft, and stable. May my mind become clear and balanced. And in this moment, may I breathe with ease. And finding that place that makes the most sense for you to rest your attention, be it the body, the breath, sensations, energies of the heart, whatever it is. Pick that place and try to stay there gently and persistently. The mind will wander and know that that's just what the mind does. And then come back and begin again. This quality of arriving here over and over again. And we'll sit quietly. As we continue with the meditation for a few minutes, I want to offer you this beautiful haiku from Joseph Hutchinson. Cliffside daisies swing from a pinch of dirt. Hold on, my heart says. Cliffside daisies swing from a pinch of dirt. Hold on, my heart says. Now bringing to mind, what is it that holds you up? What holds you in place? What are those structures externally that hold you? What holds you in your body, in your heart, in your mind? What holds up your spirit? What is that pinch of dirt that it can feel like sometimes that holds you up? The magnificent writer Rebecca Solnit says, remember what you love, especially in unstable times. Remember what you love. What do you love? Who do you love? Who loves you? Let that be with you too. And how do we hold each other up? Hafiz wrote, I wish that I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. Sensing into your own being. Breathing here, softening, resting. Resting in what holds you up, in what you love, those who love you. Coming back I think it's very important, and I have found it as a very fertile and rich practice to remember experiences of love, who I love, what I love, those who love me, what holds me up, because sometimes it can be easy to forget that. Right? It can be easy to forget, and whatever the circumstances are of your own life in your immediate circles, maybe things are going great right now. Wonderful, really important. Savor that, know it. And we also know that things are tough in a lot of places. And so remembering what you love, knowing what holds you up, I think is a path to joy and resiliency, and even resistance that says, no, this is where I stand. This is what is really important to me. So I want to talk about joy today. And I think there are big joys and little joys all around. And sometimes it can be hard to remember or to see them or feel them. So we'll start with that that's also true. But I want to talk a little bit more about this. Joy is a path to resistance, or is an act of resistance and a path to resiliency. And I want to say from the outset, what are we resisting? And I think that that is a personal question. What is it for you? Do you feel a quality of resistance of, no, these are my beliefs, this is what is important to me? Or is it resisting external forces? And maybe all of that. But resiliency, I think, is a soft receptivity. Resiliency is this ability to stand back up after you've fallen down. And it's different for every single one of us. We have different wiring, we have different conditioning. And so we can all, you know, we can experience the same, let's say, minor car accident. And it will affect all of us differently. Somebody might just get right up and move on, and that's the end of it. Might take weeks for somebody else. And I say minor because in the realm of what car accidents can be, they can be pretty big. But it's important to recognize that we all have different capacities to find our way back to standing after we've fallen. And so resiliency is soft, it's open, it's flexible. It's not one way. So in the study of the Brahmaviharas, these divine places of being in the heart, they include metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, appreciative joy, and upekkha, equanimity. And it's often said that with each of these Brahmaviharas, with metta, the heart loves, with compassion, the heart responds, with mudita, appreciative joy, the heart delights, and with equanimity, upekkha, the heart allows. And I think this is a beautiful framework to think of the heart being able to be trained and supported and habituated towards love, towards responsiveness, towards delight, and allowing, letting the world in. Things can come in, they are as they are, and our resiliency and our capacity to meet them is our practice of being with. So I want to talk about joy specifically today, and not just mudita. Mudita, I think, is a glorious aspect of the heart, to really be able to celebrate somebody else's good fortune. But let's widen it out to joy in a bigger way. When I think about joy, I think of it as contentment, as ease, as delight, happiness, a sense of uplift, even relief. I don't think of it as the big bang of, you know, oh, happy, happy, joy, joy. And it is that. It is that. But it is much subtler and more complex than that. And in the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Now that might sound contrary to what you think. How could I be happy with whatever there is? But I don't think that's what he was pointing to. I think he was pointing to equanimity and contentment, that contentment is allowing whatever there is. And we train in the Dharma training, we are training over and over again to be with whatever is and to meet the places of resistance that we don't want things to be as they are. We meet those places of dukkha, of reactivity, of where pain becomes suffering, and start meeting that also, that place that says, yeah, this is how it is. This is the truth of life. So sometimes I'll think about, well, how am I? How am I doing? And in my own perception right now, I experience what is happening in the US as a very painful shattering. And I see it as that, I experience it as that, but it also is not shattering my fundamental well-being. And I think this is what the Buddha is talking about. Happiness is contentment with whatever there is, to have enough strength of heart, mind, and capacity to meet whatever there is and still be okay. It doesn't mean it's not upsetting, but it doesn't wreck me. I don't see it as so personal. Does this make sense to you? Somebody give me a signal. You know what I'm talking about here? Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful. So here's what Hafiz wrote. You carry all of the ingredients to turn your life into a nightmare. Don't mix them. You experience all of the ingredients to turn your existence into joy. Mix them. Mix them. Isn't that great? Like, we all know that we can make a difficult thing more difficult, is my guess. And we also have a choice. And this is what I think is so beautiful in our Dharma practice, is that over and over again, we have choice points. How am I going to be with whatever there is? I have fully the capacity to make things worse, for sure. And that's actually the second noble truth. Right, there's a cause of our suffering. But pain is part and parcel to living a life. What I do with that is what is key. So I can make it worse, or I can say, oh my God, this is really hard. All right, how am I going to be with this? And it's the habit of mind and heart that teaches us, I think, to do an end run on the second noble truth. That says, all right, things are hard. What are my options here before I just react and go off? So, happiness is contentment with whatever there is. I am training in being with. So here's a piece from Ross Gay in his book, The Book of Delights. Anybody familiar with Ross Gay? Such a beautiful, beautiful writer. Highly recommend looking into his work. Years ago, 5 or 6 years ago now, he gave himself the assignment. He's a writing teacher, I believe, at the University of Indiana or Indiana University. And he gave himself the task to write an essay every day on delight, that he wanted to really study how does delight work. And so it's beautiful. It's called The Book of Delights. So here's a piece from it. He wrote, "Among the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say came from my student, Bethany, talking about her pedagogical aspirations or ethos, how she wanted to be as a teacher, and what she wanted her classrooms to be. And she said, what if we joined our wildernesses together? Sit with that for a minute, Ross Gay says, that the body, the life, might carry a wilderness. An unexplained tor unexplored territory, and that yours and mine might meet somewhere, somehow, might even join. And what if this wilderness, the perhaps the densest wild in there, thickets, bogs, swamps, uncrossable ravines and rivers, is our sorrow? It astonishes me sometimes how every person I get to know, everyone, regardless of everything, by which I mean everything, lives with some profound personal sorrow, not to mention the existential sorrow that we all might be afflicted with, which is that we and what we love will die. Is this sorrow the great wilderness? Is sorrow the true wild? And if it is, and if we join them, your wild to mine, what's that? What if we joined our sorrow? And what if that is joy? I think that's the question here. How do we live inside the sorrows and the joys and know them as the same thing, as one? the relief of shared sorrow. Right? Have you had the experience ever of sharing your own sorrow with somebody else and they say, oh yeah, I get it. I get it. And it's a shared experience in which everything that is true is held in a bigger space and it becomes less painful. There's a little joy. That is this capacity. When one of the definitions I love of compassion is when my vulnerability can meet your vulnerability, and there's an honesty and a conversation and a kindness that comes out of that, pain becomes less painful. That's been my experience. Because I think what we're really doing in our lives, what I've really learned in the practice of the Dharma, is about kinship. I think what we're doing is this true refuge in Sangha, that we celebrate each other, we console each other, we companion each other. That's really what we're doing, is consoling and companioning and celebrating. A very dear friend of mine yesterday lost her husband of just about 50 years. And she wrote to me today and she said, you know, people are saying I'm so strong, but I'm just being me. And I've learned this through the Dharma, that there's some peace, there's some love here, I can be with this. And that's beautiful. That's pretty extraordinary. You know, I think that kind of wisdom that she's lucky enough to have access to through many years of practice is holding her up through the sorrow. And she could write to me and say, I'm actually okay. I'm at peace right now. And that doesn't mean the grief won't come and go, because it does. It's just barely started. But happiness is contentment with whatever there is, which is joy. And here is a poem from Brian Doyle that I love very much. It's called Joey. A while ago, I got sick. It was a thorough and major sick. Lost use of the old hands and feet, which was, as you can imagine, weird. My kids called the sickness the thing. I could tell you lots of stories about the thing, but there's only one story that I want to tell you. Every morning, my son got up early to help me put my socks on. I would sit on the back stairs in the dark, and he would wrestle my socks on, and neither of us would say any words, and I still can't think of anything cooler than that. I've racked my brains and considered all the possibilities of love, and I still return to that boy and those socks. No matter what happens to me, that happened to me. That's joy, right? That is joy, to be so present, to say, I can't use my hands and I can't put my own socks on, but my son does this with me every morning, and that's joy. This is what I think we're training in. This is really what it is. What an amazing amount of resilience to do that and to say, yeah, I got this thing, and what else is true? And one of the very important perspective questions that I'd like to offer to you when things may be difficult is that you can say, all right, well, what's going on here? What is true here? And you can see whatever is happening for you. And sometimes when one gets really caught in the difficulty and the suffering and the rumination and the perpetual thought loops of difficulty, there's a really important question to ask oneself, which is, what else is true? What else is true? Well, we woke up today. We are still alive another day. Hopefully there's food in the house. You can make breakfast. You could turn the heat on. Might be a beautiful day and the rabbits might be scurrying around the yard. What else is true is a way of expanding perspective that's very, very supportive. It can open one up to joy. Any questions so far? I know we have the chat off, but you know, you could always make yourself known. I'm happy to do that. All right. So let's talk about joy a little bit more. In the perspective of the Dharma, there are four kinds of Dharma joys. And the four, and then we'll break them apart, meditative joy, the joy of understanding and realization, the joy that comes from skillful, ethical conduct, and mudita, appreciative joy. So meditative joy, let's talk about that for a minute. If you've ever had the experience when you are in meditation and the mind is very still and everything is very quiet, that can be joyful. You might have that feeling of bliss energy. It's known as piti, P-I-T-I. And it can be when different kinds of energies move in the body that are a byproduct of the concentrated mind. They don't really mean, oh, now I'm awakened. It's another way of learning, oh, this is what happens when the mind is really concentrated. And not everybody gets those sorts of movements of energy in the body, the PT. But if you've ever had the experience of being in a quiet, still place from your meditation, and it feels good, and you might feel rested, refreshed, reset, that's meditative joy. And meditative joy is beautiful, and it isn't, I don't think it's the point of why we're meditating. You know, my own feeling is that the purpose of meditation, of settling the mind, of really becoming still, is because it opens a space for wisdom to arise. That's what happens, I think, over time. It also settles the nervous system. It certainly does that, and it can really offer some very deep grounding, and that is joyful also. The second kind of Dharma joy is the joy of understanding and realization. This is so great, I think, because these are these moments that are, aha, oh, now I get it. Have you ever had that feeling of understanding something in a way that was deeper, that when you get that aha moment, it matters and it somehow changes you? I've had that experience in me. I experienced that through metta practice. Initially, metta was very rote, just repeating all these phrases, and then it started to change my heart. And maybe sometime we'll have a chance to talk, to really do some in-depth practice together on metta. But these are moments of deepening understandings that I think are awakenings. There are times of awakening, and the way I relate to awakening is when I understand something deeply and it stays with me. And now I get it. Oh, that's what this is about. And it doesn't go away. That's the other piece about these deep understandings. And I think it builds momentum. It just helps me keep going and keep going. And Sayadaw Utejaniya, he said, "You should be happy when you know or understand anything." Isn't that great? You should be happy when you know or understand anything. Give yourself credit for your learning, for staying on a path of practice that sometimes is really hard. That you might think to yourself, why am I doing this? Oh, this is why I'm doing this. I know why I'm doing this. To recognize this beautiful path of practice that deepens your experience, my experience, of being in the world a little more kindly, a little more consideration. What I really also think is what I am doing here is training in doing more good and less harm. And every single time I experience the restraint of not causing harm, that is the joy of realization and understanding. Oh, I get why this really matters. Kurt Vonnegut wrote, "Please notice when you are happy and exclaim or murmur at some point, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is." Right? Can you let yourself know goodness? If this isn't nice, I don't know what is. And you know those lines in that very famous Mary Oliver poem that says, "Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it." Are you familiar with that? Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. And I think that those three lines are truly, really important instructions for joy. Because if you pay attention, like really be present, the chance of being astonished increases, right? Because you're not missing beauty, you're not missing goodness, you're not missing a potent, poignant interaction with somebody. It wakes you up to being right here, to pay attention and then be astonished. And there's all this science about awe and reverence and the astonishment. I'm talking about the kind of astonishment that brings you into more joy, more presence. And certainly there's astonishment of hardship, which also brings you into a lot of presence. So paying attention and being astonished, and then when you tell about it, you're connecting with somebody else, sharing what you've learned, sharing something that is important, that brings you more alive. And it's in the experience of healthy connection that we thrive. And that is joy. That truly is joy. And the third, skillful action, ethical conduct, the delight and pleasure one feels as a result of the fruits of one's skillful efforts. So just as George was talking about generosity and dana, the Buddha said we start with the practice of dana. And once we really work with that and understand it and it becomes part of what we practice with, then he said, I'll teach you these other teachings. But this is a source of joy to cultivate non-harming, kindness, compassion. And that doesn't mean that you might get an ignoble thought. You might say something snarky because we're human. But this is a training, right? We just keep going in this direction of doing more good and less harm. And when we've caused pain, I also think that this is the Dharma also teaches how to make amends, to say, I'm so sorry I hurt you, and I see how I did it, and I won't do it again, and then retraining and not doing it again. So, in the experience of states of non-greed, non-ill will, and clarity, ethical conduct arises, and so does joy. When we actually can transform reactivity into responsiveness, into appropriate action, that's beautiful and it feels really good and it's reinforcing. Every time we get it right and we actually are kinder, wiser, it's a feedback loop. Oh, this is how it works and this feels good. And as being a human animal, it's natural to want to feel good. Of course. But all of these states of non-greed and non-ill will and deepening states of clarity, require a certain amount of letting go. Oh, this is how things are. This is what it is now. And one of the definitions of suffering that I think is quite apt is suffering is the imperative in the mind that things be other than they are. That comes from my teacher, Sylvia Boorstein. Suffering is the imperative in the mind that things be other than how they are. Right? So that's that grip that says, but it shouldn't be like this. And many of us, I think it's a pretty common feeling. But it is like this. So if I can release my grip on how I think things ought to be, it doesn't mean that when they are painful or wrong, causing harm, that I should just say, oh, okay, well, it's what it is. I can say, all right, it's how it is. How am I going to be with this? What is the correct action? What is the appropriate action? But it takes the blinders off. One of the things Sylvia said once we were talking, she said, don't duck, don't duck. And I thought, oh my God, how can I not duck? Meaning like, be present, face what's here. And at different times, we have more or less capacity to do that. And that's the resiliency that we're cultivating. Even in the Metta Sutta, at the very end, the last lines, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from unwholesome sense desires, is not born again into this world. It's a deep teaching about what does it mean to let go of fixed views. And that's a huge conversation about what about my beliefs? What about what I think is right and wrong? How do I hold that? Do I have the capacity to listen to somebody else's view that might be very different from mine? Maybe the answer is yes, maybe the answer is no. The heart opens and closes. The heart opens and closes the mind too. This is all a training. And then mudita. Through all of these forms of kindness, what we are doing is habituating the mind towards kindness. Over and over again, habituating towards more good and less harm, towards seeing more clearly what is happening in one's own heart mind. So mudita, appreciative joy, vicarious joy, shared joy. I think I heard this communal, I don't think this is exactly the right word, but something like communal effervescence, the ability to really feel happiness and joy when it is present, no matter if it's, well, in this case, it's not mine, it's yours. Can we really celebrate somebody else's great good fortune? And I think that of all of the Brahmaviharas of metta, and compassion, mudita, and equanimity, I think that mudita, this appreciative joy, might be the hardest one. And the reason I think it might be, you might say, oh, what are you talking about? Of course I can feel happy for somebody else's great good fortune. But not everybody does, because there are things that get in the way, like envy, jealousy. Why me? Why not me? How come they get it all and I don't? And that praise, blame, how these things work, it's a big deal. We can look at these eight worldly winds of gain and loss, pleasure, pain, fame, shame, praise and blame, and see how it gets in the way or can get in the way of truly feeling happy for somebody else's good fortune. And the reason these are the reasons I think that it's hard. But when we get out of our own way and can really see what's happening for somebody else, I think that is the doorway into compassion, the doorway into loving kindness and equanimity, because it really requires the letting go. It's not about me. And of course it's about me. Like, yes, we're very self-referential. It's how we make sense of the world. And yet this is a practice that is saying, okay, we are all connected. The teachings of anatta, not self, that we are all intricately and infinitely connected to everything else. And this is how mudita works. And, some of the ways that one can experience it, we often cry at weddings, cry at births, when it's not our wedding, it's not our baby being born. It touches into something that is in our wiring that is so, I think, magnificent. That we really can feel joy for somebody else's experience. And partly is our wiring. We have mirror neurons, which are the neurology that when you walk in the room, you can feel the energy in the room, right? You can walk into a space and say, oh, it feels so good in here. I want to be in here. What's going on? Or you can walk into a space and go, ah, a lot of tension in there. And this is all pre-verbal. It's not something you're deciding on. You know it. You know it when you're moving into that space. So when you have joy happening and you want to share it with somebody else, share it. It's really important. It supports well-being profoundly. Or have you ever had the experience of maybe having a rough day and you call somebody up and say, "Tell me something good. What happened to you today? Tell me a good story." Because you are borrowing their joy to say, "I need it." And that is mudita. Mark Nepo has this great poem. It's called A Pearl of Wind. Tell me a story, any story. Tell me what happened or what didn't happen or what you hope will happen. I need signs of life to lift my head. I need some pearl of wind to open my wing. So sing me a song for yourself, but let me listen. I don't care if you're trained or shy or can't hum a tune. Just sing anything. It will stir my heart. We can do this for each other, can't we? That is mudita. A really important aspect of joy is sharing goodness, really sharing goodness. William Saroyan wrote, "Seek goodness everywhere, and when it is found, bring it out of its hiding place and let it be free and unashamed." Don't be ashamed of your joy. Celebrate other people's joys. This is so important. And it takes practice. Joy takes practice to notice it, to pay attention, to be astonished, to tell about it, to know that Joey sitting on the back stairs and putting on the socks of his dad who couldn't use his hands anymore is joy because it connected them. It's a way of saying, "I see you, I love you. There's more to you than this disease. That's just the thing. But I see you and I see and feel what is happening between us." Happiness is contentment with whatever there is. And the other part about this is that everybody is worthy of this kind of joy and happiness and love. It's not reserved just for a few people. And if you've ever felt left out, that it didn't include you, as the Dalai Lama would say, is that's a mistake. That is a mistake. It's not true. Everyone is worthy of love. In fact, the Buddha said, you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. This is also our practice. So before we talk with each other, I want to offer a shorter meditation. This will just be about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back. So come into a posture that works for you, please. If you'd like to place a hand over your heart, do that or not. Close your eyes if you like, or a soft gaze down. And let come into your mind people who have loved you over the years. People who've been there for you during difficult times. Supported you without judging you. And who stood by your side even when it was hard. Think about the people who have celebrated your greatest moments of joy with you. The people who saw your successes as theirs. The people who derived such pleasure and fulfillment from seeing you happy. See if you feel their love flowing through you, lifting you up, brightening your mood and filling your heart. And know that that love is always there, even if they're not physically with you, because you carry that love in your heart. And know that you are and always will be worthy of that love. It comes to you because you're alive and you deserve it. And now, switching, see if you can think about the people who you have loved over the years, who you've been there for during difficult times, who you have supported without judging, who you've stood by even when it was hard. Think about those who you've celebrated their greatest moments of joy. And you could feel their success inside of you. The people who you derived such pleasure and fulfillment from seeing them happy. And trusting that that love will always be here. That this love is carried in your heart and in theirs. And they are worthy of your love. You are worthy of theirs. Maybe offering, imagining those people again and offering them the beautiful blessing, may your happiness grow, may it continue. And to yourself, may my happiness grow, may it continue. Just getting a sense in your own body and heart what this might feel like in the body, in the heart. This shared love, shared happiness, joy. And coming back. So I want to share with you that a little bit of history on that specific guided meditation. It actually came from Vivek Murthy, and Vivek Murthy was the US Surgeon General in the Obama administration and in the Biden administration. And he's done a tremendous amount of work in studying loneliness and what connects us, and that loneliness is actually a very real health hazard. And he's doing a lot of teaching actually on mudita, on that we can take joy in loving others and in others loving us. And that really what will heal our communities is this kind of connection towards the good. And when he finished medical school and he said to his mentor, "Now what do I do?" She said, "Vivek, stand in your strength so others can find you. Stand in your strength so others can find you." I find that incredibly uplifting and confidence building to know for yourself, this is what the Buddha said. What supports your well-being and go in that direction? What does not support your well-being and disentangle from those habits? And in the cultivation of this kind of love, of this kind of joy, of this kind of resilience and saying, no, this is where I stand, The violence stops with me. I commit to more good and less harm. Others will find you. And we do this together. And this is another part of Sangha that is so important. That is joy. So thank you for listening, and let's open this up and talk with each other. And Marita, I see you there. Would you like to unmute? Whoops. There you go.
Wrong button. Hello.
Hello.
I'm in Stockholm, around 1,500 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. That's a reality, too.
It is a reality, isn't it?
Mm. But I just want to share something. some weeks ago, I had a bad fall.
Oh, no.
I stumbled and fell and hit my head.
Oh, no.
And I had some angels, so I didn't break anything, but I ended up in hospital for a couple of days. And I've been practicing Dharma in and out for years, having children, you know, family and everything. And the Dharma has always been there like a thread. But in periods, I've been discouraged because I thought for myself, where is this big enlightenment?
Yeah, good question.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I ended up in hospital, I had my mobile phone and I opened Spotify because I needed something. And I found a playlist with Tibetan mantras.
Oh, beautiful.
And I had these mantras for 25/7 for these days, during these days in hospitals. And I remembered that, wow, I only need the bed's length to do walking meditation because I can stand on my legs.
Yeah, there you go.
So the practice was already there.
Isn't that remarkable that you have these feelings of, okay, where's the great enlightenment? Where's the great enlightenment? It's in the small things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You had your mobile, you could listen to the Tibetan mantras and be soothed by it.
Yeah.
How are you
realizing
now?
That healing is in so many different layers.
It is. Oh, that is so true. I'm so glad you said that, Marita. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, because the body could sometimes, the body is overwhelming almost all the time.
The body is overwhelming almost all the time, more or less. Indeed. How are you now? You all right?
Yes, I'm all right.
Thank you so
much,
Marita.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love you all.
Thank you. Bartek.
Hi, Heidi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I like your talk, and the meditation was great also, you know, to recall the person that we care and they will care for us. It's very powerful. I love the mudita practices also. I think they are transformative. I just want to share a little bit. And I also have a question regarding in the letting go. And where's this mudita, the real joy, coming from, right? Is it, it's within us, like in everyone. Would you agree with this? That this joy is our natural essence, right?
I think so.
Part of it, not only that, but like you said, there's four Brahma Vihara, there's like the love, you know, the compassion, and there is the equanimity. They all come together and, you know, and they're in balance. So I heard that, well, we need to do a lot of letting go, you know, to get to the place where you said, you know, when the mind is quiet and the joys naturally start to arise. And it's very energizing. It's really reassuring also state. But how would you say that we need to perfect those qualities? Do we need to perfect them? Because if we do the letting go practice, right, and we purify the mind, so do we still need to, perfect those qualities, or they should be naturally, perfect already, if we, well, I know it's a far, probably far off stage, the arahantship, but that's where we're heading. That's where everyone's heading, right? They're trying to purify the mind, to. So how would you
So it's a great
help?
question. So it's all happening all the time. And my experience of this, and there may be people who've been practicing for many years longer than me, but over the last 25 years of very dedicated practice, I keep coming back to, I just have to keep going. That the purifying of the mind happens bit by bit. Every single time I don't say something that would be harmful when I could have said it, when the practices of appropriate speech come in and I actually get it, that is a moment of purification. And when my heart actually can lead the way instead of my mind, I think that is a process of the perfections. But I also feel for me, and I can't say this for anybody else, that we have the languaging of purification and perfection. And I wonder sometimes if that language specifically holds way too high a bar. That there's a great line in the Verses on the Faith Mind, which is a Zen, beautiful Zen treaty. Treatise that says, can we be without anxiety about non-perfection? And that is a beautiful teaching in and of itself, that perfection is a construct. It's an idea we have that comes from comparing and some, external circumstances saying, oh, this is what is perfect. And then, in Zen, it already says, you're already perfect. You just need a little improvement. That's what Suzuki Roshi said. You're already perfect. You just need a little improvement. So, what would happen, Bartek, if you took those words out of purification, get rid of purification, and get rid of perfection, and be here with what's real inside of you, and let yourself be guided by what you know is really true. And then take these teachings, but be careful of the words that might cause a little bit of trouble. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be confusing because,
Yeah.
how do we know where's the end? Nobody really knows because,
That's right.
right?
That's
We need
right.
to be aware and mindful all the time till we die. It's not like, okay, I'm done. No, and we're not, even the probably the highest lamas or, arahant, they need to be present and mindful and constantly be aware of the present moment, and like you said, what's true and what's here and now,
Yeah.
and what's
Just
right,
keep
and
going. Just keep the keeping going, the cultivation of kindness and wisdom and the dedication to non-harming. To really say, I don't want to cause harm. I have a very strong vow inside of me that is, I will not let ill will take up residence inside of me. Because when I do that, that causes more harm in me and creates it lets greed and ill will and delusion solidify themselves. I don't have to like things. I can take very strong exception to things, but I don't let the ill will really get its hooks in me. And I think that is a purification practice, process. And I think it is a development of what if we define the paramis as the perfections of the heart. And maybe that is a translation issue. Like, who translated parami to perfection? I don't know who the scholar was, like, where did that come from?
yeah.
But we're going in this direction of love. That's what we're really doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a great answer. Appreciate this.
Thank you. Okay, help me with your name. Oxolotilton.
Yes, it's social. Sorry.
Oxolotilton.
Yeah.
Welcome.
You. Yeah, I think today the practice was much needed. I don't know, just been through turbulent times, and for me, it's like, oh my, not again. Like, and
Yeah.
it's just so disheartening because, like, it gets to a point where it's so hard to get up again, right? Get back on your
Yeah.
feet.
Right. Oh, it is. It is.
Think like things are going, you know, well. Then something happens. Trying to, and then the season's like everything gets cold now, and I don't mind the season changing, but my body just like has a hard time getting up, you know. And I'm like, well, maybe I should just rest.
Maybe you should.
11 a.m. And I'm like, it's too long.
Okay, so then you have to know what is enough and what is not enough, but also the compassion of, oh, this is really hard to get up again. Self-compassion is really important when things are difficult to say, things are difficult. This is painful. This is hard. Because in the naming of how it is, there's deep allowing. It says, yeah, this is what's happening now.
Yeah, and it's hard because like I couldn't cry till yesterday, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
And like, why? Like crying helps me too because I know it's needed. Oh,
Yeah.
but you know, I'm investing in my education again after going through a career change and so forth. And now it's like to the point where I'm like, I'm gonna have to call my mom for some help because not lose the place where I live, you know. But it is hard.
Oh, it is hard.
So I'm just gonna have to go just to date a time, and for some reason it's been so hard to find work. Anywhere I tried, and even having a master's degree. my school time takes time in the mornings, so finding evening jobs has been hard.
Yeah. And you know,
But
hard things really are hard.
yeah.
And there's not an easy answer to this, but it is true that compassion is really important when things are difficult and even when they're not. But because sometimes what you're describing sounds like it's building, like there are a lot of things that are painful, and the pain of not being able to get up and the coldness is painful. And so maybe doing a lot of metta for yourself just to come into, and the self-compassion, may I be kind to myself. May I be kind to myself. This is hard. It is a way of practicing that I have found helpful. It doesn't necessarily find me a job. I mean, let's be realistic. But how I talk to myself, can I be kind in how I talk to myself, is supportive. I wish you a lot of luck. I can hear the pain.